Good morning, Lenore.
Morning, Bridie.
Good morning, Patrick.
Morning, Bridie.
And good morning, Gabrielle. Welcome back to Newsroom Edition.
Thanks, Bridie. Great to be here.
Great to have you. This week, Anthony Albanese told The Nation that in 2025, we've turned promises into progress. I want to unpick that a bit and look back on the year that the government has had as a whole. Lenore, Albanese is adamant this year was about action and he sees it as a success. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, to a large extent it does. I'm sure Anthony Albanese would answer that question with a list of his election promises and all the ones that he's ticked off or partially ticked off and say, see, I'm doing what I told the people I would do and that is successful. You know, and he did have a massive win in the election campaign, so I can see that he would look at it that way. I think, though, there is a slightly different way of looking at it, which is how Australians are feeling about their lives and about politics. And you know, that picture might be a bit obscured by the opposition being such a complete shambles. But if you look at the most recent poll, 60% of respondents told our Guardian Essential poll they were feeling pessimistic that Australia could deal with the cost of living. 58% that said they were pessimistic about affordable housing. In the Resolve poll, I think two-thirds wanted immigration paused until the housing supply had caught up with demand. I know from the start Anthony Albanese has said he wanted to run a steady, calm government, and he's definitely doing that. I just feel like there's a slight disconnect between that and the way people are feeling about their lives and how quickly their lives are changing.
Yeah, I think health policy is actually a really good way to look at the problems that they face. They went to the election promising so much on Medicare. They made a record investment on Medicare, which is great. And bulk billing rates have improved a little bit as a result. Great news for them. People love their urgent care clinics. More great news. But there's a lot of bad news in health too. I mean, people can't afford to see a specialist. Still, people are having trouble getting to see the GP, and the government is trying to negotiate a really difficult hospital funding agreement this week with the states. So it is one of those areas where he would probably tick off some big wins.
Justifiably.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the problem with Medicare is that it has been slowly dying for a really long time. Did they create this problem themselves? No. But people are desperate for some fixes.
They've also got big challenges coming up there. There's a expense of running hospitals is rising. States are under an immense amount of pressure to keep those systems going. And there's always this financial tug of war between the states and the federal government over who will fund them and how they'll be funded. But I think there were two sort of major wins, I guess, for the government this year: environment laws getting passed, delivering election promise, which they failed to do in the last term of government. I think they can chalk that up as a pretty substantial win, getting it through with the Greens. I think the other one that sort of flies under the radar is continuing with the electrification of the grid. More and more renewables are coming on stream. It's something which by the end of this term, there'll be such a great penetration of renewables, solar, batteries, wind, that I just don't think the coalition, if they wanted to, could even turn it around now. It's got so much momentum. There's so much investment pouring into it. So I think that's a win which is probably not recognised as much as it could be.
Another one that's sort of on the fence is cost of living, because, you know, they've done some things like increase wages for care workers, wipe up 20% off HECS debts. Like, there's stuff being done. But they just ended the electricity rebate, which I think was the right thing to do in a public policy sense, but is going to hit people in the hip pocket. And if you want to go back to the idea of how do people feel as opposed to what's being ticked off the list, I think that's probably another one.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's going to be their probably number one challenge next year. We've got inflation, which is ticking up again. The government is under a mass pressure from the coalition over government spending. So what do they do?
Interest rates aren't going to go down again. They might go up.
Yeah. And it feeds into that point you were making earlier about some of the dissatisfaction with Labor is probably masked by what's going on with the coalition at the moment. Wayne Swadden had an interesting intervention earlier this week saying that Labor's support is wide, or was wide at the election, but it's actually not that deep. And when you kind of dig into it, there is an opportunity there for sort of disenfranchised voters or aggrieved voters with cost of living and so on to flock to a populist right, and things could change quite rapidly.
I do think that they will end the year pretty happy with the social media ban laws being passed. It has been largely greeted with a lot of enthusiasm around the world. And Anthony Albanese actually said on Wednesday, you know, be proud today and remember this day. I think it will go with the other great reforms that Australia has led the world on. So I think that's a pretty happy note for them to end the year on.
And going back to voters' feeling as compared to the government's checklist, what specific areas do you think voters would have liked to have seen more progress on this year?
I think if the government wanted to use its political capital to do one big thing, you know, to take one big political risk, I think it should be in housing policy. They have got a housing policy. They are ticking it off, you know, that building new homes, affordable homes, the first home buyers grant. But that first home buyers grant is also sort of acting to inflate prices. And actually, at the end of the year, housing affordability is still getting worse. And I think that problem hits almost every sort of part of society. It's worsening inequality. It's worsening intergenerational inequality. It's so much embedded in that feeling that people have that their lives are difficult and they can't see how they're going to get better if they're going to do one, as Paul Keating would have said, you know, two skis, one pole downhill kind of scary thing. I reckon it should be that. I don't think they will, but I think that's what it should
be. I agree with that, but I think it's got to be done through the lens of tax reform. I think that's something that the crossbench has been pushing for quite hard. And the question of housing is just tied to the question of how we deal with assets in our tax system, capital gains, negative gearing, so on. But I think if you were going to do one thing, you need to look at the tax system as a whole. The burden is falling much more on younger people. It's going to continue. We've got an aging population. It does need to be done, but I think everyone is so petrified of it. It's not fair. It's not equitable in any way.
Yeah, I think housing sits right at the heart of our inequality crisis, and I just keep coming back to this conversation that Andrew Leigh had with Patrick Commons earlier this year when he had done some analysis and said, we are now as unequal as the US was in 1980, and follow that through a generation, look where it leads. You know, we all know where it leads, and we don't want Australia to be that kind of society.
But what was Andrew Leigh's solution to this? What's he putting forward?
Well, you know, I think there are a lot of people in Labor, right, who want to do more economic reform, especially around tax. So it will be interesting to see what they do next year.
I thought it was really interesting, the essay that Sean Kelly wrote, the quarterly essay called The Good Fight, about this balance between how far you could go and how carefully you govern, and Albo's style of governing carefully and cautiously. I think the things are really linked, because the sense of whether they are not going fast enough or wasting time is really dependent on how long the calculation you make in government of how long you think you've got in government. And I think that might go to the differences in those analyses. I think Anthony Albanese is really thinking that he can lock Labor in for a really long-term government and therefore he can take his time. Others looking at political volatility think you might not want to bank on that.
And Patrick did reference the coalition earlier and their domination of the headlines in certain months of this year when perhaps they didn't want to be dominating the headlines. Can you see a route back towards electoral success for the coalition, or is this a real existential crisis?
I do think it's an existential crisis. I think it's more than just a bad year or a bad year after a terrible election result. They're being pulled to the right by their very, very conservative small base and by the Nationals. That means they lose votes to the Teals on the left. I think Susan Lee's doing the best she can in what is actually an impossible situation. I thought there was a very interesting discussion of that on our sister podcast, Back to Back Barry's, last week, where Tony Barry, who's a former Liberal strategist, said that the things that the Liberals are doing are sort of basically going to mean that they can't get back to power, like opposing net zero, which voters see as a proxy for we care about climate change. So I think, I don't know where it will end, but I can't see a way through it without some pretty major reorganisations politically.
I feel like I'm a bit of a parrot on this podcast sometimes, popping up and saying existential crisis for the Liberals. But it is. And I think the reality is that it's got to get a lot worse before it gets better for the coalition. They've got to hit rock bottom and then go even further and into the bedrock. And then they will realise that actually we're on the wrong track. We have to change. We have to do something.
Or something will change structurally.
I thought Ron Boswell wrote a very interesting column in the Australian on Thursday, and I can't believe I'm about to quote him. But he said, first, never underestimate the chaos that fringe movements can create.
Yep.
And second, hold them to account.
Bozzy fought the far right his whole career. Mm. But I thought also was quite interested in an analysis piece that Phil Khoury did in the AFR, which was sort of loosely talking about how the Teals are approaching all of this, because the Teals are now looking at the Liberal Party, I'm assuming, and saying, well, the moderates in the Liberal Party are almost non-existent. We are capable people. Should we be aiming for something more than hoping that we have a balance of power vote on the crossbench? Now, I have not made too many calls on this. I don't think there's anything absolutely formulated yet. But you can see a future where the Teals try to sort of combine with the sort of moderate end of the Liberal Party to form a centrist, centre-right party grouping in some way, which was what that Khoury article was going to. I thought it was really interesting, and it makes sense that those kinds of loose discussions would be happening.
And what about Susan Lee in all of this? She had a very rough start to her leadership, but has she been given a proper chance at the job, or do you think she's just not up to it?
I don't know if she's really been given really any proper airtime to succeed as a leader since she came into the job. She's inherited a party in disarray. You just think of all the things that have happened this year alone, you know, the fight over net zero, Barnaby Joyce's defection. Yeah, I just don't think she's been able to give it a red hot go, and I'd restrain from judging her until she gets that kind of opportunity.
I've got to say, I think she has made the best of a completely impossible situation.
And really quickly, how did the Greens fare this year?
Yeah, I was trying to think about the year for the Greens, and, you know, they obviously had a bad election result, but in some ways I feel like they are now putting the pieces back together, trying to work constructively with the government, getting the environment laws passed, which required compromise, I think has put them back on track. They've managed to keep any internal divisions at bay. We haven't seen any big fights amongst them. They're in a reasonable position heading into 2026, I think. But I think David Pocock has had a very good year. He's kind of the breakout star of Senate estimates. They've had a few issues where they've fought really hard on, like the FOI changes, the Briggs report into the Jobs for Mates. They were really strong on that. You know, and David Pocock, again, you know, I think his Instagram reel on that was viewed something like a million times, which is pretty good for an ACT independent senator.
It's, I was about to say, he's the breakout star of my Instagram feed.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because normally it's the left wing of the Labor Party that's kind of the conscience of the Labor Party pulling them to do more. But the left wing of the Labor Party runs the caucus now, and the left wing of the Labor Party has the Prime Minister. So it's kind of like the crossbench, the Teals, the Pococks are the people kind of pushing for more reform.
Yeah, exactly, and particularly on something like gambling reform, where I think, you know, they've obviously got supporters within the Labor Party, but they're the ones that are free to speak out about this and do the, you know, Instagram reels and the TikToks on it.
That was one of the interesting things in that Sean Kelly essay, that in caucus meetings sometimes no one asks the question, like, since when? Wow.
That is staggering. Why do you think that is?
Because they're all sort of, you know, happy in government, owe their seats to the Prime Minister, many of them, and
he runs a tight ship. So just stepping outside of Canberra now, as we get to the end of the year, what is on your mind in general?
I'm really scared about where the immigration debate will take us in 2026. Sorry to bring the mood down, but I think we started to see it play out already. You know, the misleading term mass migration has kind of entered the mainstream. But I think what we can't lose sight of is how these so-called debates affect real people. You know, when politicians or commentators get up and blame the housing crisis or crowded hospitals or traffic jams even on immigrants, those debates affect the lives of people who came to this country to work hard and have a better life. And they keep people up at night. They create stress. They embolden people to be rude and racist. And that makes life really hard and sad and stressful for real people. And I think given that we know where some elements of Australia might take this debate next year, we're obliged to keep these people at the heart of our reporting.
Yes, I do think that there's going to be a lot of reporting on this issue next year, and it will be one of the things dominating the headlines.
I'm also going to bring the mood down, sorry, but it's my birthday today.
Happy birthday, Patrick.
The last few days of 1979, but the thing that's really depressing me is this news about Indigenous deaths in custody. So we started as a country counting Indigenous deaths in custody at that point, at which I was born, in 1979, 1980. In that year, there were 4 Indigenous deaths in custody and 15 overall deaths in custody of the whole prison population. Since that time, as a proportion, the prison population in Australia has doubled in size, and which is also leading to more Indigenous people behind bars and more Indigenous deaths in custody. Last year, we had 33 Indigenous deaths in custody, which is a pretty grim milestone. It's the highest level ever. We've had national agreements. We've had royal commissions. We've had so many attempts to fix this, but it's going backwards. And even the rhetoric around it is getting worse. You know, in states, we're seeing turning the clock back to the 19th century with locking up kids for crimes that they don't even have the, you know, capacity to understand wrong. 13-year-olds behind bars, it's all wrong. We're heading in the wrong direction on this, and I don't think enough attention is given to it.
Lenore, what about you? What's been on your mind as the year finishes up?
Many things, but one of them is I'm trying to assemble a sort of reading list on AI for the summer. I mean, I've read a great deal about it over recent years and particularly this year, and clearly it's sort of changing everything, including our industry. But I guess I feel sometimes like I'm reading something and it feels like I'm kind of doing grade 12 maths and I haven't fully understood the grade 10 maths. So I'm sort of going to go back and try to sort of read into the whole question again over summer. So wish me luck.
I am not surprised that you are spending your holidays going back to school and all. Next, hope, electricity and logging off.
The Free Birth Society made millions selling a simple message to pregnant women. You don't need ultrasounds, doctors, or midwives. You can free birth. But behind the scenes, terrible things were happening.
I feel ashamed about this, but I didn't think that the deaths were bad until a year after I left.
Subscribe to the Guardian Investigates feed to get all the episodes of The Birth Keepers. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. Out now.